Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
My guest today is one of the most talented and diverse songwriters and music producers in the game. He has had multi-platinum success writing and producing for major artists such as One Direction, Katy Perry, Fits in the Tantrums, Train, Daughtry, The Fray, Carole King, Neon Trees, Weezer, and Gym Class Heroes. He's written and produced 21 U.S. Top 40 pop hits. In 2008, Rolling Stone honored him with the Hot List Producer of the Year Award, and most recently he co-wrote Fits in the Tantrums' smash single Hand Clap. I am honored and excited to have with us today my good friend and a guy I've looked up to for a very, very long time, Mr. Sam Hollander.
Whoa, love this guy. Hey, Joe.
So we've known each other, it's probably going back like 15.
Longer.
Maybe 20 years now. And
Bad Ronald's what, 2001? So
yeah. I wasn't around for the start of Bad Ronald.
You weren't around for year one.
I wasn't around for the start. I was around for the end of Bad Ronald. But how we know each other, we're basically from the same area. You're a Westchester guy.
We're from the 914.
914. Were you born in the 914?
I was born in Manhattan, and we moved to Chappaqua when I was, I guess, 3.5 or 4. And then, yeah.
And then you went to Fox Lane.
I actually was in Chappaqua. I went to Roaring Brook Elementary. My brother went to Bell School in Greeley, and when he graduated Horace Greeley, his last year at Greeley, we moved to Mount Kisco when I was in fifth grade, and I attended Fox Lane High School, along with such luminaries as Susan Day, the Partridge Family,
yeah,
and John Schneider of Dukes of Hazzard, and
those are the big alums.
Marissa Winokur from Celebrity Big Brother next week. Good squad. So
and then I feel like I know you through so many different people. You were working on the Katy Mara like girl group album when I met you.
It's very funny. That was an interesting one. I would say that was probably my finest hour.
Yeah.
You know. you know, there was an opening for a girl group. I got a call that a friend of mine was developing a group and needed a vocalist. And at the same time we just met Kate. And
yeah, right. I always forget now. Now Kate.
Sorry.
Big time movie star.
So the funny thing is I always say Katie, but people correct me. To me, she's still Katie.
Yeah.
I also haven't seen her in 10 years.
Yeah.
So if I said Katie, maybe she might be offended.
I don't know.
But when Katie Mara, and Trisha and Rooney was Trisha.
Yep.
You know, but, I got Katie, cast in the group and we wrote some songs together and Katie and her family were lovely enough to take us to the bulk of the 2000 season, including the 41-0 giant Viking beatdown at the Meadowlands.
Yep, and I was there as well.
Yep, and with 2 minutes left, we all went down to the field, and as the confetti rained down and they gave their speeches, we were standing in the center of the field with the whole team, and unfortunately, nothing has beat that moment since. I've been to a couple of Super Bowls. I've done the whole thing. Nothing even competes. That was it.
And what's amazing, because we're both big Giants fans, we were both at that game, the NFC Championship game at home.
Yep.
That we've never, as a team, lost an NFC Championship game. That's the only time.
It's an amazing fact.
The only time we've lost a Super Bowl after.
It's an amazing fact. And I remember we viewed the Super Bowl in my apartment on 10th Street in the Village in New York, and we had about 20 people in the living room, and I was manic and screaming at the TV all the way up to the pregame. And then Ray Lewis ran everybody on the field and led everyone in the push-ups.
Yeah.
And right then and there, I started getting all misty-eyed. I was like, we're going to get destroyed.
I know. It was so early in that game that I knew we were done. I remember
over.
I almost severely damaged it, and I didn't go to the hospital, but I probably broke it. I punched my freezer.
Awesome.
I was at Lehigh University and punched my freezer after the Stokely touchdown.
There were so many problems with that team, but nothing would compare to that Viking team who really should have been the squad, and they came undone. And I'll never forget, at one point, the Bad Ronald, a manager who managed this group, Bad Ronald, asked me to produce a Playmates solo project that she wanted to sing. And we met at some hotel on Sunset Boulevard. We had breakfast. And she said she was dating one of the stars of that Viking team. And she said, you know, just so you know, the weekend before that game, they all went partying. And she said they were all doing E. They were all like on ecstasy and everything and tabbing up and all this shit. And that's why they got demolished. Now, I have no proof, but right. I would say, I just remember she said, you know, yeah, she was throwing everybody under the bus. And I thought that was pretty neat, but. Yeah, the Giants have been a major part of my life. I actually, you know, my claim to fame is as a kid, I was a ball boy / autograph blocker for the 86 Giants at Pace at the training camp. Because as you know, we grew up near the training camp. So that was my summer job. And I impacted Hollywood history at that job. Do you know that?
How's that?
I'm going to tell you. I was sitting on the ground with the two other fellow, gate watchers, and we were sitting on the base of the field as sort of beneath the end zone. And, you know, you didn't fraternize with players. You didn't talk to them. They weren't, I would say that 86 squad, not like a lovable bunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, they hold a place in my heart. Pretty serious,
pretty serious crew.
Like Brad Van Pelt wasn't coming over, like, you know. Yeah. Like, I think, did Brad leave in 80? I think Brad might not be on that 86 team. Gary Reasons, though. Yeah, I think Gary Reasons and Landetta and Bavaro's a rookie and all these guys, they're all sort of around, but they're not really hanging with us. And I'm a smiley kid. And, you know, you think you get it back, you get nothing. So I was kind of scared and intimidated in the process. But LT was the one you stay away from. You know what I mean? Everybody knows you stay away from LT at all costs. So we're sitting there one day, and LT walks past us, and he looks over at us, glares, and says, "Where's the nearest bowling alley?" Right? So these dudes go silent. And I'm precocious, so I said, "Mount Kisco Lanes, you know, 4 miles down the highway." So I map it out for him on paper, you know? And that's a Friday, or Thursday or Friday. I come in on Monday, and everybody, like, I just feel like the energy is just all the air has left the room. And I'm walking around, and I just feel like, oh, man, like, why is no one talking to me? What's wrong with my fellow guards, you know? And one guard hands me the newspaper, and it says on the back of the Daily News, LT's Porsche stolen. And it's stolen outside the Mount Kisco bowling alley because he had gone that night. He had taken some girlfriend or something, and he decided to park. I believe he parked sideways with his purple Porsche across two handicapped spots with left the keys in it. So he, a kid who it turns out further on down the road is a kid I grew up with, was actually caught and arrested for it, I believe. But
he was just doing valet work.
I really couldn't blame him. I'm like, man, if you're going to, you know, I'm going to evict the car too. But it was a big deal for about 24 hours in the news cycle. But LT came into camp that next day.
And He's like, you sent me to the bowling alley where they steal cars.
They steal cars, and I'm left with my chick, like, you know.
Which, by the way, is probably like the third car in history stolen in Mount Kisco.
And also his third girl, like, in the night. So it's like the side piece of the side piece of the, you know what I mean? It was such a, it was an awful display. Okay, so fast forward, it's about 13 years later, and it's not that I've forgotten it, but, you know, all these things start to fade. And I'm watching The Waterboy. And if you remember The Waterboy, at some point, I think Fairuza Balk might come up the stairs, and she says to Sandler, what are you doing? She said, I'm watching LT's Porsche.
That's amazing.
So that's $100 million movie.
Yep.
I'd like to think I played a
pivotal role. You get a writing credit at least. And you know what's funny? I've told the story on multiple podcasts. Parking across multiple spots was apparently his go-to move.
Did not know that.
I went to Joe Namath football camp in Connecticut.
Did you? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
At Quinnipiac College.
And
I did.
And we all get on the bleachers because they have multiple pros that are going to come and speak. And LT is on the list. Yeah. And as young Giants fans, we know probably 50-50 he doesn't show up. So everybody else speaks like not nearly the big, you know, Beasley Reese and Dockery.
Yeah.
And so we're waiting. Is LT going to show? Is LT going to show? It's about 5 minute delay where we're like, okay, he's not coming.
Right.
And the Porsche speeds in the lot.
Awesome.
Like he's going like 85 as he pulls in, comes across three spaces, like screeches to a stop, gets out of his car, probably leaves the keys in it. And some security guy who's working the parking lot comes walking over, and he's kind of like, he's probably 30 yards away, but we can hear the conversation. And the guy goes, "Sir, you can't park there." And he goes, "What does this say?" And he points to the giant dangle earring.
The earring, of course.
And he goes, "LT." He goes, "Yeah, that means I can park wherever the fuck I want." And just strolls. It's, you know, 40 kids between, you know, 8 and 15 hear him say it. And he strolls across and he just starts talking. And it's basically the scene in Waterboy where he's like, "Don't do crack, kids."
Yeah, he was a unique character. I can't believe you went to Joe Namath Camp, by the way, in Quinnipiac. So I went that the summer after ninth grade. And although I did play 10th grade football, I think Joe Namath Camp put a fork in football for me because I was a big kid and they bumped me up out of my age group to the next level. And I was such a pussy that I literally feigned injury not to play in the game on the Saturday.
You went full Jay Cutler.
Totally.
Like, can't do a torn ACL going home.
My mom came down for the game. I remember my mom was there to pick me up. You know, it's the final game, you know, that last day. And I'm on the sidelines. I'm like, "Mom, it's a hamstring. I can feel it. I can feel it." That's when I knew it wasn't going to be my vocation.
And is that the start of the music career? You're like, "That's it. Football's over." And
you
now
know, I hung around it for a while, you know, on the fringes, but I was writing in journals. Probably the summer of ninth grade, I started really taking writing seriously. I would write, you know, endless sort of poems and things and just sort of had binders and binders of crap that no one knew about. And I auditioned for a band in the town, and I got lead singer for one day, and they fired me. And it's funny because one of the cats, my friend Paul, actually, you know, we became friends later in life, and saying, "Man, you should have just kept me in it, man. Just like, you know, I swear I would have stepped up to the challenge. You just had to give me another shot." But they bounced me. And I finally got my own band together senior year. And we did a couple of shows. And we did the Battle of the Bands at Horace Greeley High School, where 8 bands competed. And we came in 7th. And the only reason why we didn't come in 8th is because the band who should have won it turned out their rhythm guitar player might have been 50. And no one
not
really,
a high schooler.
Yeah, so they got bounced, and so finally we weren't in last, but I was pretty bad.
So how does the music career take off? You go from being in a band, in a high school band, to like what happens? Where do you go to college? What's the music background?
My journey's pretty awesome. I graduated. I'm sure you can understand by my thought pattern. I'm an ADHD kid, missed it, undiagnosed, right? So my parents
that was before they were just handing out Ritalin.
Yeah, I missed Ritalin by a window, and I feel like my parents were those parents that wouldn't have let me do it anyway. And but I was a colossal fuck up. So my parents were super academic. My dad was a professor. They're both really Ivy League and really, really, really heady. And then they birthed this just disgraceful human, you know? And by the time I left high school, I graduated 2-something out of 250 and applied to 13 schools. And I got into 2 schools. I got into the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, and Temple University in Philadelphia. So I chose University of Pacific. Now, why did I choose University of Pacific, you might ask? Because Lionel Manuel had gone to University of Pacific of the New York Giants. And when you went through the program, it said his major was music production. So I asked him about it, crossing the lines one day, and he said it was a great school. He gave me 6 seconds, but I thought, "Oh, shit, Lionel Manuel went there. It's music production." There were no schools for it back then. There was very few programs. So okay, so I got on a plane and I went out to the University of Pacific. My parents didn't fly with me. They put me on a plane. I was a terrible child, and they were very happy to get me the hell out of the house. And
they were like, "Yes, go to California."
Yeah,
you're not interested in Hawaii.
Yeah. And by the way, 18 years old with connecting flights and all this stuff to Stockton. And I arrived in Stockton. Long story short, basically, you know, there's no bus to meet us. There's nothing, you know. And it's me and another girl who had we had transferred to Detroit. She got out of Detroit, and we kicked it the whole flight. She was great, but we both were sort of apprehensive. We get in the car, And our driver is all methed out, like 87, probably early crack wave, you know, like he just out of his mind. And we're driving through Stockton, which is a depressed community, really been through some tough times. And it didn't look like the program. Didn't look like what I'd seen. You know, there's no internet back then.
Yeah.
So this doesn't look nice. I'm like, what? Where am I? This isn't California.
Where's the green grass?
Yeah. Where's the beach? You know. And the driver's driving us to the campus, and he says, "I said, so you know, so are you from here?" He said, "Yeah, I just graduated University of Pacific." Oh shit. You know. And we show up there, and he drops us off at the front. I have whatever, you know, 5 suitcases. No one to help. There's no greeting. And me and this poor girl spend 1 hour kicking our bags up the path till we get to the dorm. I get to the dorm, and, you know, one just comedic thing after another over the next 8 hours. And I had a nervous breakdown. And I called my parents. I said, "I'm getting on a plane. I'm coming home." And they said, "Oh, no, you're not. No, you're not." I said, "No, I truly am." And
I'm leaving my bags here.
I don't ever want to see them again, you know? And I was lying in the grass outside Stockton Airport, which was, you know, really small, like, you know, puddle jumper kind of airport. I'm lying in the grass, and I have black shades on, and I'm staring up at the sky, and I had, like, the most intense awakening where I realized that after 18 years of dicking around, I had to do something, and I had to manifest something. And I came back that night, and I really got proactive, and I woke up the next morning. My parents wouldn't speak to me, by the way. They didn't speak to me the entire drive home. And first thing I did, I called up Temple in the morning and explained that, you know, because school – and by the way, remember, California school started earlier.
Yeah.
So there was still 2 weeks before Temple started. I begged. I pleaded, and they let me attend. So I got to go to Temple for my first semester. I went to Temple in Philadelphia, but I wanted to be at NYU because NYU had the music business technology program. So NYU had rejected me, obviously, when I applied. But there was a woman's name on the rejection letter from admissions, and I don't remember her name. I don't remember how it began, but I started calling her once a week from my dorm at Temple, leaving messages. And saying, "Okay, so, you know, just a little heads up, you know," and Temple's in a rough section.
Yeah.
"So, you know, my roommate last night, you know, he was walking down the street. He got jumped and, you know, got hit by a bottle, but it's okay because I'm going to survive because I'm doing it." And I'll, you know, and I kept leaving these crazier messages.
She's your therapist.
She's my therapist, but she's
not listening.
Never picked up the phone.
Yeah.
But they would usually be 2 minutes. I said, "You know, and today, you know, I'm not, you know," because I was in a television and film program at Temple. I was called RTF, Radio, TV, and Film. And I really wanted to be in, you know, music, technology, and writing. And I kept leaving these messages. "Well, today we studied the early works of Hitchcock in film. Of course, this has nothing to do with what I'm going to do with my life, but it's okay because, you know." So by the 10th week or 8th week of calling this woman, she finally picked up the phone, and there are about 5 or 6 other voices I hear in the background. She has me on speakerphone, and they're laughing. And so they actually engage me, and I tell them my saga. And I say, "Look, I'm reformed. I'm going to be a human. I've, like, figured it out. I've seen the light. It was in Stockton, California." And I just give the whole thing. And I transferred for my second semester. I was in NYU. So I went from, like, this colossal fuck-up to a kid at NYU my second semester of college, which was really my finest grift of all time. What I would tell you about it was I, of course, then dropped out of NYU 2 years later. So it's almost, you know, it's like winning that NFC championship and then just crushing the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, but I
and you drop out of NYU 2 years later because you started biz.
I got a record deal, and that's why I dropped out of school. But I will tell you a funny story that I do like to tell at speaking things. When I got to the school, there was a woman running the department, the music business technology program, and she was great. She was she was very cold. We really couldn't connect on many levels. She was very attractive, and a little older, but really, you know, when someone just calls bullshit on you from day one,
yes,
hated me. So, and like I said, you know, I was a whirlwind of positive energy at this point. I'm gonna do it, right? So I used to walk into her office occasionally and just say, "You know, I'm going to get a record deal, man." Like, you know, because I was at the clubs, by the way, 6 nights a week in the city. I was hanging out at every venue. I was cutting demos on 111th and Broadway with my friend Jimmy.
And who are the people that are in the clubs around this time? Like who? It's real hip hop. What's the scene like?
It's real downtown hip hop heads. And I, of course, have nothing to do with it. But then I'm also hanging out in this other scene. I live about four blocks away from Nightingales. So I'm around on the periphery of the early Blues Traveler, Spin Doctors, The Authority, Milo Z scene. I'm sort of a peripheral figure over there. But most of my time is spent at hip hop shows at SOBs and Wetlands and anything, you know, anything of its kind, like real early hip hop stuff. And I'm certainly all the native tongue stuff. And, you know, once again, on every scene, I'm a peripheral character who doesn't belong. But, you know, I'm making friends, and I'd say I thought people dug me. And, you know, so I'm telling this woman, I'm going to get a deal. So doesn't even like when I say it, she's like, yep, cool. Okay, great. Thanks. You know, give me nothing. So on a Friday night, I go out in the rain, and you know, I used to stand outside the Sony building with cassettes and duffel bags and hand them out to A&R people from Columbia who I'd seen in Billboard. Like I out hustled anybody, and I still believe
these are cassettes of you, just like that you recorded in your
rapping on 111th Broadway, Jimmy Musson's apartment, like me rapping over, you know, samples that I was chopping up and things like that. And a band, and I had players playing on stuff, and you know, it was pretty messy. But, you know, there were ideas at least. And the music business is full of more polished stuff that is devoid of ideas. I've always been solid with ideas that might not be as polished. So I go back to the office. So I mail out this cassette in the pouring rain at that post office on Chelsea on 17th Street between 7th and 8th. And I remember putting in the mail, and I'd send it to a label called Ultrax Records, which was a division of SBK. SBK was, at the time, the hottest label. They had Wilson Phillips, Technotronic, and Vanilla Ice. Ice was signed to Ultrax Records in Plano, Texas, and was a subsidiary of SBK. So my friend so I sent it to this label because I figured, hey, man, they like Caucasian dudes who rap, you know? So I sent it to them. And 24 hours later, when they got it, they called me up and they said they wanted to fly me down to Plano. So I walk into the woman's
You got there and you're like, they rerouted me to Stockton somehow. This looks exactly like where I spent one day.
Plano was like man-made Lake Stockton, you know? But I I knocked on the woman's door who was, I don't know if he called the dean or whatever. And I said, hey, just, you know, I think I got an offer. They're going to fly me down. You know, this record label's flying me down south and with all that swagger. And she said, yeah, good luck. I said, okay, cool.
Nashville? No, Plano.
Plano. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I was really upfront about the details, but so I do 3 days in Plano. I'm courted like I've never been courted anything. You understand? I'm in high school. I'm like a JV starting receiver who gets benched a few times and drops everything thrown to him. Like I've just never really been great at anything and been totally functional at anything, you know? And this is the first time I've ever been recognized where I feel like, okay, I'm finally special. And it was 18 years of my life where I felt like, okay, somebody finally thinks I'm something. So 19. This is 19. And I'm in Plano, and we're there the my final night. They court me, right? Everything, you know, they take me out fishing and doing all these things in Plano on the man-made lake, you know. And we go to the museum of JFK's death, where I see his like brains being blown out over and over on loop, and all these crazy things. And the final night, I go to a record release party for a band called the Mac Band. And they're having a record release party at a recording studio in downtown Dallas. And they have and the label's there, you know, and they're signed to the label. Interesting fact about the Mac Band is I think they might be in the Guinness Book of Records of the tallest R&B groups ever. I believe that they were brothers and they were all above 6'5", which I always thought was like, you know, Montel Jordan held that crown. Imagine five Montel Jordans singing R&B, you know. So these are some big-ass dudes. But I'm at this thing and at some point, they pull out a projection screen. They said, we're going to debut our new music video. It's going to go to BET this week. And you guys have like these girls. I mean, it's just like a scene. It's pretty fun. And I go and take in the video, and I'm sort of sitting up front, and I'm watching it, and it's smooth, and it's like one of those BET, like midnight smooth Donnie Simmons jams, right? Like real late, you know? And it's like, oh, girl, some smooth stuff, finger snaps, ooh, you know? And then suddenly, like, there's like a chick who's kind of like in a negligee. She's dancing. Everything goes silent in my brain. And I said, oh, shit.
It was the head of my department at NYU, dancing in a negligee in an R&B video.
No way.
100% true. So I start losing my shit. So I run over to the lead singer and I look up at this dude. I was like, yo, I have a quick question. You know, where did you shoot this video? He's like, New York. I was like, oh, word? Okay, cool. But do you remember the woman's name? And he says her name. Oh, you knew her first name. So Tuesday morning, like in all my Ferris Bueller swag, I walk into that office. I knock on the door. You know, I walk in. Hey, so I just got back from my weekend in Plano, Texas. Doesn't register. Nothing. Doesn't even look up. So, yeah, so it was great. They really, I think I got a record deal. It's pretty exciting. You know, it was trippy though, man. I went and they, I got to see the premiere of the new Mac Band video.
Now she looks up.
She looks up, looks up, looks back down at her paper and says, what I choose to do with my time is my time. And I said, absolutely cool. And I walked outside the door. I dropped out 2 weeks later. That's how I dropped out of college.
You've been like, also, I got a deal and I'm probably going to make a video at some point. So
she was cute. But I, was the end of academia for me.
Yeah. So what's your project? What's your name? What happens with this deal?
You know, what happens with it is, you know, I rap, I make a record, and I'm signed to a label that has Chub Rock at the height of Chub Rock, Kid and Play at the House Party era.
Yep.
AMG for Bitch Better Have My Money, one of the classics. And I'm on the label, and my project's called Sam and the Swing. And you go to eBay, it's a big Japanese seller. It usually lists, you know.
Big in Japan.
I'm very big in Japan. You can find it on compilations in Japan. It's a 90s hip-hop classics, man. You ask any rapper live, they'd gut me if it was ever put in the category of classic. I did try, you know, I was very arty in my own head, so I was rapping about beat poets and all this other pretentious shit, but I was a terrible MC, but my ideas were
and
cool.
And now Jay-Z's rapping about art, so you were way ahead of your time.
By the way, way ahead of that guy.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I remember when Jay-Z and Jazz were doing Hawaiian Sophie and all that shit, so, you know, I was around. I love all of it. But, okay, so I'm signed to this label, and I'll tell you how it ends for me. I'm in the office, and Kid and Play come in. The label's called Select. It was a division of Atlantic Records, and it was their hip-hop division. And I'm in the back, and we're taking a look at my album cover art. I'm in the back with Amy Bennick and Gail Gezzi in the art department. And I'm standing in the back, and Kid and Play walk in the office. And, you know, one thing you learn about record labels, which I'm sure is the same with comedy clubs, is like when the luminaries walk in, it's like, man, all hail, you know?
Right.
So Kid and Play on top of the world, they walk in and everybody's stroking these dudes, you know? And I'm in the back, and they make their way back towards me. And then Play looks at me and goes, oh, man, you funny. You a funny dude. He's funny. And everyone
heard it.
And everyone's looking around. I'm like, oh, God. I'm like so fucking mortified. I'm like, oh my God, he thinks I'm a terrible MC. He's laughing at me. You funny. Yo, this dude is so funny. Yo, hugging me, all this shit. I'm like, okay, I have no idea. Is this like a fight thing? Like, where is this headed? And then he says, "Yo, Jerky, you Jerky, Jerky." Well, the label, I thought I was the only white artist on the label, but they went out and signed the Jerky Boys.
That's amazing.
And the Jerky Boys had just been signed, and the Jerky Boys ended up being the breadwinner for the label. And my record was shelved, finally limped out onto the streets like a year later. But I knew that at that point that if I couldn't compete with prank phone calls, I knew that, you know,
the Jerky Boys got a movie out of that. They were the biggest thing in.
Well, the lawyers, Harry Getzoff, really sweet guy, was the manager of the Jerky Boys. He was managing it internally. And so I would just watch this thing blew up. You know, I was privy to watching a lot of things blow up along the way. And I would say what that does is, you know, when you watch a couple dudes making prank phone calls, suddenly making features, and you can't get arrested doing what you're doing, you got to rethink your game, you know? And that was really a pivotal moment where I said, all right, I got to flip this on its ass a little bit and figure out who I am. And really, you know, in all fairness, I was 22, 23. And I spent the next couple of years searching the next 5 or 6 years searching. And there was always one end goal, and that was to write songs. And I was trying to find a way to access, you know, these records I wanted to write on. And at the time, it's funny because as Smash Mouth and Sugar Ray and all that pop rock came up in that era, you know, I wanted to write with those guys. Nobody's taking me in the room. You know what I mean? Who the hell am I? So I met my manager, Brett, outside Brownies in the East Village. We were like 24. And he became my manager at 26 or 27. He's been my manager for about 20 years, 19, 20 years. And what's interesting about the dynamic is when we met, the first thing he said to me is, you know, what do you want to do? And I started singing. I said, man, I kind of want to be like, I see myself as Malcolm McLaren making pop records. You know, I want to create bands. I want to write the songs. And it's the only way that anyone will ever work with me, because I've been an outsider now for the last 5 years. Nobody cares. So unless I sort of enter the machine my own way, it's never going to work. And we set up that blueprint even then. You know, we said, okay, we're going to do this. And it took us a long time. As you know, it took the first 5 or 6, you know, they all sort of fell by the wayside for different reasons. I do have the distinction as the only writer I know who the first 4 albums I made on major labels, wrote and produced, didn't come out. And the 5th came out on September 11, 2001. So it was a very ugly stretch, but I would say it sort of lit this. The tenacity was just at a whole other level, and it still is. I don't know. I think I still have such a outrageous chip on my shoulder from the Jerky Boys that I never got over, and you know, sort of just had to figure it out.
So the reference he makes to September 11th, that's the Bad Ronald album.
Yeah, you know, Bad Ronald was
who actually a lot of my
core
group know Doug Ray.
Okay,
he actually wrote and performed the jingle for the now defunct Kooks of Comedy podcast,
okay,
which has been called the greatest podcast intro song. I think that's what he should focus on these days.
Doug Ray, you know, Bad Ronald was, you know, I thought it was my finest hour. I was very proud of myself. The idea being that I was a big Beastie Boys fan, I was a big Far Side fan. I wanted to combine the two and put an ad in the Village Voice, got 3 kids, 2 of them turned on 1, and suddenly there was an opening, and Aaron Handelman, a.k.a. White Owl, another Westchester kid who was a very, very skilled MC and a sweet, nutty character who I really dug, said, hey, you know, you got to check out this kid, Doug Ray. And he played it for me. And Doug had that deep-ass voice, you know. And, you know, and Doug was a senior at Albany, and I think he was probably just going to go straight to law school. And he came down to New York, and he just had this incredible swagger. Like, I just wanted to be his friend, you know. There's certain artists I meet. It's usually the front people. You know, it's usually the star. Because you think, oh, man, I wish that guy was my friend. That guy would be a good friend. And Doug Ray was that guy. I thought, man, this kid is so cool. And he was, you know, younger than me, but he was so much cooler than I was. So we put that thing together, and it was at a time when we were phoning in record deals, and those guys got a 2-firm record deal for, I want to say, you know, $1.2 million or some crazy amount. This is like, you know, the great days of the music business. Like, you know, the stupidity was at an all-time high. And, you know, we made this record, and I have to tell you, 100 records later, it's still one of my favorite records. Like, that record was ridiculous.
There are some gems on there, that's
really
for sure.
Really some gems.
All the girls like Big Dick.
Hey, yo, I need love like I need a hole in the head. I need to come home to two bitches waiting in bed. I need handcuffs so the chick don't leave. I need NyQuil and a blowjob to get me to sleep. I need a hot bitch to show off around town. I need collegiate pussy singing We Can Get Down. I need a late night account that a jerk too for weeks. I need my face buried in a lap till I can't even speak. I need a gang of hoes trying to fuck each other. I need to bust in their face and wipe it up with the covers. I need girls that won't talk back to me. I need 1, 2, 3 bitches actually. I need big titties on a chick that's not fat. I need to stay clean with a backpack full of hats. I need them, and they need me. I need love, like I need the air I breathe.
When my head is all messed up, and I feel like I'm all alone, I need to meet somebody.
And it was, we were all playing really great balls, working with Dave Schomer, you know, at the time. We were known as Pop Rocks, producing stuff together. And, you know, we were both, like, hyper creative, and, you know, and those kids were super creative. And we all just had so many ideas, and that was a great record. And then, you know.
Well, it's funny. That's right around the time where I met all you guys. The first time I met Doug Ray was that summer when the single is already out on MTV.
My first song ever on MTV. The first song I ever had on MTV was in the episode where I believe when Steven slaps Irene on Real World Seattle. And that was my first ever license on a television show, and I was emotional that day. Oh, I'm on MTV. I love Road Rules or Real World. I love Real World Seattle. I love these people. Irene has Lyme disease, and I know. I get it.
And Lyme disease, that was the best.
And the whole thing, that was my favorite. You know, I'm a pop culture freak, so that was big. But then, you know, suddenly I had a song on MTV in rotation, and everything looked like it was changing. And on midnight of September 11th, like the beginning, you know, 8 hours or 9 hours before the planes, we're in Union Square. And as you remember, we have in the Virgin Megastore window, we have the flat.
For our young listeners, yes. There used to be record stores.
There was a thing called a record store, but it was located at 14th and Broadway. And there was this flat. They would take new releases of records and they blow them up, you know, to wall length. And that's how they advertise the records. And our record was in the corner position on 14th and Broadway. So I had seen it for a straight month leading up to the release. And I lived at 11th and Broadway or 10th and Broadway. So I would walk by my record every night thinking, this is the one that's changing it all. I'm finally, you know, I'm out of the boondock. You know, and that night we were partying at Virgin Megastore. You know, they stayed open till past midnight, you know, on record release nights, and we were raging. We were having the best night ever, dancing. I still have the photos of us dancing in front of the record cover. And then 9 hours later, it was
because records would drop on a Tuesday.
Yep.
So that's Monday night. You're going out. I remember as Giants fans, Monday Night Football, Giants, Broncos.
Yep. Exactly right.
I was there. I was on 20th Street. I was drinking at Barfly at my apartment on 17th and 3rd. And like, you know, I'm six blocks away from where you guys are
celebrating our glory.
Celebrating your glory.
Don't spike the ball too early.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talk about that billboard position though, but. Yeah. I mean, 14th Union Square, that's like, it's downtown. That billboard would tell like downtown hip kids, like, oh, this is something you should know about before you hear, like, boom, here's the first thing.
It was truly, you know, potentially an iconic cover because it was the Easy Rider American flag helmet. So imagine the American flag. Now imagine ten hours later, you have people walking up covered in soot from the World Trade Tower. And we're watching this. You know, I live at 10th and Broadway. I'm right in the middle of it as watching the towers go down. And these people are standing in front of this image of the American flag. And these people who are looking for lost ones, you know, their family members, et cetera. It was so harrowing and so awful. I felt so terrible for everybody. And it just That was the toughest day ever. I mean, I just felt so bad. You know, it was such a like we were so scarred. I had panic attacks for the next 7 months. My wife did too. You know, our manager got blown out of his bed, his glass blown in. Brett did, you know, from his window down because he lived next to the towers. So, but I don't want to segue off that. That was awful. But we
but now when it's like how long into that morning? Because obviously you guys are same as I was out watching the game, drinking. You're out celebrating. How early in that morning do you get up? And then how long into what's happening do you have any thought that this might have an effect on what you guys are doing. I mean, obviously, people aren't going out and buying records that day.
I have so many thoughts. I mean, what happened was, you know, we'd been out till about 2 a.m, went to sleep, and Brett called me like 3 times in a row, and he's screaming. And, you know, my manager is very understated. And he's screaming.
The last time he screamed.
Exactly. And he's screaming, and he's saying, look, you know, he said, you have no idea. Look out your window. And we saw that the first plane was already in. And we watched that, and then we turned on the TV, and we're watching this. And then we panicked. We went down, and I watched the tower go down as I was standing in front of the – right behind the arches in – you know, in Washington Square Park. I was standing on Fifth Avenue in the middle of the street. In fact, I ran into a good friend of mine from high school, and she was standing there too. We were all so freaked out. We ran to my studio on 20th between 6th and 7th. We hid there for a minute thinking, oh my God, like, is the world ending? Panic, panic, panic. I didn't have any chance. I didn't even think, Bad Ronald didn't even exist for a long time after. I was just so freaked out. We got in a car that night. We fled the city, and we drove to Cape Cod, and I stayed there almost 2 weeks hiding. And I was so, you know, in just panic. And, you know, I mean, I saw some crazy stuff. And when we were there, during that time that I was on the Cape, Brett would check in, and Brett was in terrible shape, you know, with, like, stuff in his lungs and stuff. And then but he called, and he said, you know, I think Warner – pulled the tour support for Bad Ronald. And they had been on the road with a band called Lucky Boys Confusion, and they had, you know, it was like, I'm not saying like, you know, we were headed, you know, they were on some miracle ride, but it was beginning. And then suddenly they pulled the tour support, pulled everything on the record. And the great punchline was they got dropped by the label 2 months later. They were in a two firm and they got dropped. They paid us out. And they got dropped. And then a week and a half later, the studio, they all get invites to the Warner Christmas party. And I still kept those. There were CD invites that were recorded, and I still have those. You are invited to the Warner Reprise Christmas party. These poor kids, like, their lives are, you know, they, like, it was a tough fall.
And it's, and for people who don't know the record, it's, like you said, it's Beastie Boys.
It's raunchy.
Fun. It's raunchy. Yeah. I mean, the video that was out all summer is there's a dancing condom, this girl's in underwear. And this is now, people just want to hear the saddest U2 song on repeat.
It was just, yeah, the whole world, the tone of the world had changed. And it was fascinating because I just, these kids, like, it was almost like they were pariahs overnight, and they were such great kids. And I watched it all come undone, and it was tough. And so immediately they all fell apart. So personally with Dynamics, but Doug was the one that I had, I really connected to the most in terms of as an artist. Kaz was the one who was, you know, making beats, and he's a great kid, and he's still a great friend. But Doug, you know, Doug was a real front man. And we kept going with Doug for a long time, and we just tried a lot of different things, you know.
And I mean, we laid out your extensive resume to start this podcast, so mm-hmm. everybody knows what happens from there, where then you start getting momentum going. What's the first – that was obviously what you thought was a real break.
I'll tell you what happens. You know, I really owe my career to three people, right? My wife for being my wife and, you know, keeping me sane. And then my manager, who, you know, is awesome and loyal and just like the hardest working cat and just really great. And then my friend Jonathan Daniel, who owns Crush Management. And, you know, it's great because my two closest friends are, you know, my manager and JD. And what I would say about both of them is they've offset each other with just – they've done incredible things for me along the way, just sort of – creatively, you know. And, you know, what happened with Jonathan Daniel was, you know, he was a friend in the city. We call him JD, you know, and he hit me up and asked me to meet him for coffee at the Virgin Megastore because, you know, he
because they were giving you your poster back.
this is 3 years later. And at this point, we've developed a few more things and gotten a couple more deals. We get a, you know, Kaz, we spin Kaz off. We get him a deal with DreamWorks. We do a disco record with Kaz called The Cooler Kids, and the label folds. Like, you just know when, like, things just, you know, you feel like, I really did feel like I had a bad moon following me wherever I went, you know? And then I was sitting with JD, and he said to me, you know, look, I love what you're doing as a writer. I love what you're doing creatively. I don't know if anybody else is noticing it, but I think you're really on to something. I am on the precipice of something kind of neat, too. I have this band. They're called Fall Out Boy. And there's something happening with this band, and I think it's a movement, and it's sort of the next wave of emo. And I, you know, I was familiar with the genre. Obviously, I listened to everything. I was pretty up on everything. But I wasn't hip to a bunch of these bands, and he turned me on to Panic at the Disco and Academy Is, and, you know, a bunch of these bands. And he said, there's a movement here, and they're going to need somebody, you know, as all scenes do, if they really want it to pass, if you want to go past sort of a small indie sort of subset and grow into a mass thing, it's going to, you know, need other writers and producers who sort of understand it. Now, that's taking a flyer on me, since obviously I didn't really understand it that well, since nothing had worked.
Right.
But I understood always how to shape a song, and I'm pretty conceptual as a writer and as a lyricist. So I sort of, and I made beats, so I could do a bunch of things. And the first band he sent me down to see was Gym Class Heroes. And I went to see Gym Class Heroes at Knitting Factory, and there were 15 people there. And I begged them to let me make a record. And it was the same sort of.
What year is this?
2005. Begged them in 2005. And I said to them, I said, look, I said, you know, I've been trying to make this record now for, I've taken 4 shots at it. I made it as an artist and failed. I made a Bad Ronald record and failed. I made a Toothpick record and failed. You know, I've wanted to combine a hip hop with a band, you know, ethos, and combine this whole thing into this crazy aesthetic that, you know, has multiple flavors to it. So it really works on a myriad of levels. And we did it.
Take a look at my girlfriend. She's the only one I got. And not much of a girlfriend. I never seem to get like.
It's been some time since we last spoke. This is gonna sound like a bad joke, but mama, I fell in love again. It's safe to say I have a new girlfriend. And I know it sounds so old, but Cupid got me in a chokehold, and I'm afraid I might give in. Towels on the mat, my white flag is waving.
And they gave me the record, and I made this record, and then strange things happened, and it was a hit. And it was the first hit, but what happened that really pushed it over the top was, as that thing was beginning to go, I was beginning to, I had this, my sort of fire was reborn in terms of, you know, a next wave of bands and putting them together, because I understood now the scene and sort of how it was working. And I was looking for kids that fit maybe our own, you know, my profile and JD's profile and Brett's profile, but a little more on the pop end, a little bit less Crush and a little bit more Ozone, which was, you know, Brett's world, which is a step more pop. And immediately Boys Like Girls, Metro Station, We the Kings. Then we did Cobra Starship together with Crush, and we just kept creating these things, and we're involved in just building up these artists. And we had a lot of hits with them, and it was just, it was insane. It just finally, imagine being shut out for 9 innings and then coming out there and putting like 20 runs on the board. It was just insane, you know? And what's funny is, the one thing that really has worked for me in life is, through all the years of failure, I constantly kept like scrapbooks and notes, and, you know, I'm a sports guy, so I just always a playbook of what I would do if I finally hit one. Because I always felt if I hit one, I could hit 100. And it took me 34 years, 35 years to get to one. But then from there, I knew I was going to just knock it out.
So now that you've had success, when you go out and you're looking, how do you get paired with somebody? Are you finding people Are people coming to you at this point?
At this point, you know, most of the time people come to me or, you know, my manager. And,
can you tell right away if you're like, this is going to work? I mean,
I'll tell you one thing. I've been right on a lot of things. I'm pretty, you know, I still believe in the concept of stars, you know, in terms of I'm a fan first because I know that I didn't have what it took, you know. I knew that I didn't belong up there. I know what I look like, man, you know. I know how awkward I am in so many ways. So when someone walks into a room and has these strange factors, when it's like a five-tool player, you know, and they just have these strange variables about them, it's rare, but I know it's going to work. Like I feel like I can spot people, you know, who have that thing. And so I'm pretty good at it. So those are the ones I sort of cherry pick. I've been doing less developing over the last few years because I still just love writing with records. And, you know, what's great is I'm blessed enough to, like, get to write with, you know, artists that I really dig. So the bulk of my time is spent doing that. But I still develop things. I'll develop a thing, you know, one thing a year. You know, a kid who I think really just – I like the oddballs. I like the ones that might slip through. Just to have like a variable that just makes them a little off.
You know? What is the process for you now in terms of when you're writing? You write with something just on your own and then you go, oh, I can match this to somebody? Or do you look at an artist and what they're already doing and go, oh, I know what'll work for this?
All of the above. I wake up at, you know, I wake up about 6:15 and I type between 6:15 and 8. I type like a couple lyric sheets or at least a lyric sheet, a chorus, a verse and a chorus. You know, and I'm exercising the muscle and I'm stockpiling stuff. And then if I'm paired with somebody if I have a week's notice, I tend to go so deep into their catalog and understand their tendencies as writers. You know, I never want to insult anybody I get in a room with. I hate the idea of going into a room and not doing my due diligence. Like I like to take pride in the fact that I'm the one who actually cares. I don't phone this shit in. So when I show up, I have a pretty good handle on who I'm working with and I know, I'm studied and then I've maybe hip pocketed some ideas I think are the right idea, et cetera. And usually gets it going. It's rare that I feel like I don't get a groove going.
What's the line? If there's one that sticks out that you're most proud of, you hit the paper and you're like, yeah, that's going to work. And that says something that.
I mean, I'm going to say, I can make your hands clap.
I can make your hands clap. Said, I can make your hands clap. Somebody save your soul because you've been sinning in the city. I know too many troubles. All these lovers got you losing control. You like a drug to me, a luxury, my sugar and gold. I want your sex and your affection when I.
You know, I think at the end of the day, what else matters? You know what I mean? Like that song says so much to me and so little, you know?
You talked about Bad Ronald, but yeah. Let's set them aside for a second. What project did you work on that you were like, this is something, and it just didn't have the success that you thought it was going to
be? BB Rexha. I mean, we found BB. She was a student at Baruch College and in New York, studying business. And I co-owned a publishing company with JD and Brett and Bob McClinn called Mighty Seven. We had a publishing arm, and we had some incredible writers. JT Harding, four country number ones, went top five Hot IC. We had some big songs. And so we ran this company, which was this incredible Bad News Bears of an organization. I mean, so scrappy. And we were cherry picking these kids around the city who were just the ones that no one else was seeing. And BB Rexha came in and, Randy Rosano, who was running our company at the time, she was running day to day for our company, brought BB in, and BB was writing with, Grant Michaels, who goes by Wonder Bread, who's a great writer, in our B room. And immediately, I heard her tone. I was like, oh shit, she's dope. Cause she's interesting. She's quirky. And I was doing a record with Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy. He was doing a side project called The Black Cards, and we've been through two singers already. So it was a mess because the label, you know, was on Island, and, you know, it was going to be Pete and a female vocalist, and we were looking for that person. But the label had already lost faith at this point because you've been through two singers and you can't get this thing off the ground. And I fought aggressively to get BB in there because I thought she was so rad. And she came in, and then the thing just train wrecked. I mean, it just sucked. We made a record that was good and not great, and, you know, it just didn't come together. We didn't maximize her. I felt like the song sucked. I don't know. I was really, really salty. But the worst part is that I spent a year of my career working on this thing when I was really hot, and I put everything into it, and it bricked. And we all walked away very salty at the end of it, you know, and, like, you know, Pete's a good friend, but, like, creatively it was just, like, sort of we all put – I think everyone was sort of over each other at that point. And look at BB now. You know, she kills, so.
Ooh, it's just me, myself, and I. Solo ride until I die. Cause I got me for life.
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't need a hand to hold. Even when the night is cold, I got that fire in my soul.
I mean, that one hurt, you know. That one hurt. But, you know, she was great. And, you know, it's funny. One of my favorite you know, one of my favorite sayings is sort of, you know, when there's a hit, it's all about proximity to success, right? And so I can still hold on to a piece of her. You know what I mean?
I saw it first.
Yeah, I've read some interviews. She gave me some love in a few early on, you know, so it's good. So I'll take that.
You've come now, like, across, starting when you, as early as you did, to still being working out. Music has changed so much, especially in the fact that, like, the digital thing, yeah. No one buys records anymore.
Yeah.
What, like, how does that affect you as a songwriter and producer? And is there the looking back on the good old days when people would buy albums? And
well, there's money in it now. It's interesting. There's more money in it in the last 2 years than I've seen in, like, the previous eight because of
they've figured out how to finally.
So, no, it's not that. It's that. I mean, they're getting there. But what I would say is the money is if you own a master. This is the time to go punk rock, because if you own a master and you put a track up on Spotify and it does anything, you're getting paid. And so that's why there are 10,000 rappers named Lil.
Right.
Lil Prano, you know, but it's just these.
We'll work on that project. We'll have to get out of here.
I mean, it's just if you own a master. So it's almost like I would say the majors are just getting crushed in many ways. But, you know, they're making money, too, because the streaming and the catalogs are streaming.
Explain even what that means to people. Well, you own a master.
Well, OK, you and I write a song today and we record it. Well, we're not signed to a record label. So we make a deal. Hey, we own this 50-50 together. And we put it up on Spotify, and let's say the thing does $10 million, you know, sorry, 10 million downloads, and it becomes like a song on Spotify, not even a huge hit, just like a decent, you know, a song that some kids heard, you know. We each walk away with, I don't know what the computations are. I'd say something like 18 grand each or something like that for one song. So think about these kids, like that kid who's about to sign, the Gucci Gang kid is going to sign some ridiculous deal, I heard, you know. It's just the streaming numbers are crazy. But the writers don't see it, but the owner of the master and the producer do. So if you own the record, if you own the recording, so I think right now everyone's in a tailspin because the majors are making a ton of money off of catalog on streaming because obviously they own all that. So they're just – majors have all this money coming in. And then kids in their living room in Omaha are putting up songs and they're making money. Songwriters still aren't. So for me – look, man, I did pretty well, so I'm okay, and I can definitely, there's no panic, and, you know, everything's cool. So I think it's very hard, though, because if you are a writer and you've only gotten to a certain point, I would say it's tough out there unless you're owning your own shit and you're putting it up yourself, and that, you know, you have to have that renegade spirit to do it right now. But God, what a great time to do it. And I have a friend, my friend Amy, like, she sits in her bedroom and she's a, what they call a top liner, and she's writing over people's tracks and everything. And then last year she decided, fuck it, I'm just going to make my own tracks, and I'm going to sit, learn how to make beats, and I'm going to sing my songs, and I'm going to put them up on Spotify. And that's that spirit you have to have right now, because one of them will go. And then, you know what, when one goes, a bunch can go. So
you use Spotify Is that your digital go-to?
I do. I love Spotify.
What's in your top played? Like, what are the songs that stay in your top played list?
Oh, man. I mean, I love Christmas and Christmas in Riverside Drive by August Darnell from Kid Creole and the Coconuts. That's my go-to Christmas standard. That makes like every Christmas playlist. And then I love a song called Bolinas by Pete Escovedo and Sheila E. Sheila Escovedo, his sister, Sheila E. Mm-hmm. And it's like a Latin jam from, I would say, 76 or 77 that I listened to whenever I head north. I go deep cuts. Like I found incredible things, you know, on Spotify. So I have so many of these joints. I've been going deep on Bobby Caldwell this week. This week's all Bobby Caldwell.
You're going to be stuck on a desert island for a year.
Yeah.
You can bring as much music as you want, but it can only be from one artist. So one artist discography can come with you to a desert island. Who are you taking with you? Great question, Joe. That's what we're here for.
It's probing. You know, I'll tell you something. I would bring Steely Dan with me over anything, anywhere, because that's who I am. I'm warm. I like a jazz chord and I just chill.
We had your leaving, that's okay. I thought our little wild time had just begun. I guess you kind of scared yourself. Turn and run. But if you have a change of heart, Ricky, don't lose that number. You don't wanna call nobody else. Send it off in a letter to your.
You know, because I'd say Tribe Called Quest, but you know what? After a while, you
right.
know,
after a while,
I don't want to hear drums. I don't want to hear drums. I need, you know, I'll start to go all Tom Hanks Castaway on these people. So before I talk to a volleyball, I think I'm going to do Steely Dan.
What's the best part about working in the music biz?
Oh, man. I mean, the camaraderie is pretty rad. You know, I would say picture your high school smoking section and picture every high school smoking section in America all brought together to hang out. And that's what it is. I mean, it's like all the miscreants and the people who couldn't really figure it out. And because of that, there's a loyalty to it. I'm a private guy, and you know, in many ways, and you know, I keep my world. You know, I like to work at my studios at the house, and I don't like working in big commercial studios. I don't like being around people when I'm working. I'm pretty focused on what I want to do. But I would say there's a camaraderie with the cats that I work with that is incredible. I write it, like I compete against, like usually there's like a group of four or five people I think like we're in the same kind of lane, and they're all really great guys. You know what I mean? And they share information, which is such a crazy thing. How many other industries do people share information so openly? And it's very fraternal in that way. And it's the friends. I mean, to be honest with you, it is such an incredibly interesting social experiment. And it's taking all these fuck ups and putting them in one place. And we have a good time. I really dig it. I mean, I would tell you, like, and especially I would say LA right now, it's a very good crew because you're getting like some of the best people I knew from New York have all, you know, come this way. Writers from Nashville come this way, and everyone goes back and forth. No one works in New York, but everyone works in Nashville and in Los Angeles. And, you know, both have really neat scenes.
And what's the worst part about working in the music biz?
Well, I think the business is full of chasers, you know, and I'm not a chaser, so I don't relate to it, and it bums me out. You have people who, you know, who are so aggressively just trying to chase trends to such an extent out of desperation. And man, the second you become that person, as you and I both know, you're five steps behind. And everybody.
Well, for as long as it takes to make music and get it out, by the time you're chasing it, it's already over.
But even so, you're still like a, you know, you're the second tier version of it. You know, people used to say Stone Temple Pilots were like a second tier version of Pearl Jam and all the Seattle stuff. But you know what, man? Those guys were such incredible writers, and they did morph it to their own thing. You know, these Beatles melodies and other things that made it their own beast. So I always thought that was patronizing to attack them that way. When I'm talking about hack stuff, I'm talking about, you know, I'll hear a single and let's say Maroon 5 has a single. Then the production is aped in 50 other records, or, you know, Charlie Puth, and then everybody has this bass drop in the chord. Like, you just start to hear the same patterns over and over again, the same finger snap and all this stuff. And, you know, it just, it's like the department of redundancy. And at some point, I like the ones who are outside the box, who think crazy and who miss, but miss awesome, you know?
Is that something that you have to decide, like, maybe a bit against your best interest not to do? Because in comedy, you're like, oh, if I just go up and I do like a Dave Chappelle knockoff, like people, it's that cadence that people like, you can make something of it, but you can make money just doing a Maroon 5 knockoff.
I've done songs that have worked that were familiar, you know, that worked within lanes, and, you know, but the shit that I love that I did was always on the other end, and it was stuff that probably wasn't genetically engineered to work, so it worked. And those songs are bigger always, you know, the ones that really also you have to separate one thing. There's like a 1% in the industry, right? The 1% are sort of the fountainhead of the industry, right? You know, Bieber, Selena Gomez, you know, Camila Cabello or Messiah, whoever, you know, those people can do whatever they want. And it still is going to work because, once again, they're trading radio shows, et cetera, and, you know, things, and they're going to get those looks at radio. And some of them, like Sia, make art that's so, you know, high art that's on such another level. And then Bieber does great pop in his own way. And these guys, they have that lane. But for every other artist, it's amazing how few, like, take those crazy shots. People take people bet conservative, and that's not my wiring.
You've worked with tons of artists. You've worked with huge names. What was your holy shit moment in the music biz? You're like, I can't believe I'm standing next to this person, working with this person, seeing this.
Carole King. Carole King was the coolest artist I ever worked with, you know, and that was obviously back in 2001 when I had nothing creatively going on. But Carole King, unfortunately for everybody else, sort of, she just raised the bar so high, and no one ever has even touched it. And I mean, honestly, like I've worked with Cyndi Lauper and Donna Summer and, you know, Nile Rodgers and just some badass Paul Williams, who's also in that highest of Paul Williams up there, Jeff Barry up there. I mean, they're all incredible. The thing about Carole King was that we were, you know, she, first of all, she introduced me to Paul Williams. So Paul is a very close friend and Carole's a close friend, but these people, these are wonderful humans, man. These are people who, like, you know, we used to have a weekend house in Pound Ridge, as you remember. Carole King used to come up to the house and hang. She came to my house, like, just on, like, a weekend just to chill, you know, Carole King. And I was nobody. I was just this guy writing with her. And it's funny because when she made – so she made this record, Love Makes the World, which was in 2001 – and, you know, we wrote against all these huge writers at the time. I believe it was like Babyface and David Foster and all those legends. But we ended up writing and producing the single with her, the first single, the album track, the title track. And there was the Gap commercial, all that stuff, which all, I think, you know, received the benefit bump of September 11th, Love Makes the World. So as Bad Ronald plummeted into obscurity, Carole King's thing, you know, saved me in other ways. So the world works in very crazy, mysterious ways. But Carole King, hands down, the coolest, like, cause she introduced me to so many rad people, man, you know? And like, and what's amazing about the old guard of like the legends is that Carole King introduces me to Paul Williams. Paul Williams introduces me to Jimmy Webb and Jeff Barry. And suddenly it's like, that's like a rotation that it's hard to fuck with, you know?
What's the single best concert you've ever been to?
Best concert I've ever been to, probably Tribe Called Quest, NYU 89. I think that's an incredible show. I don't want to combine shows, and I don't want to get this wrong because it was my freshman year and I went to a few shows there. But if I'm not mistaken, the opener on an eight act bill was this guy who came out on stage and he had a mohawk and he had this is good. Do we have time for a fun tale?
You'll
really dig this one. This one's great. So when I make my record as an artist, I end up at a convention. It's a Warner convention in Philadelphia. And, you know, you go to the conventions and you have to do a performance in front of all the salespeople and all the locals and stuff. You're supposed to take pictures with, you know, buyers from retail. So I'm set up. It's the first time I've ever done anything like this. So two things happened that day. One, I'm set up across from this kid and I'm on a major, like I'm through Atlantic, you know, my record's through Atlantic. This guy's on some shitty little record label. And they're looping his video and he's like guy doing BMX tricks, like in rapping as he's doing BMX shit, you know? And I thought, man, this guy sucks. This guy's so whack. But what I realize is he's sitting at his table and people like are really going over. And unfortunately, they set us up right across from each other. People are really going over to get his autograph in the 8x10 flats. Nobody's coming over to me, right? Me and my friend Don, you know, in my band, like we're all sitting at this table hunched over. Every once in a while, someone comes over for the token autograph, but you can tell people are like, yeah, fuck this guy. So everyone's mauling this guy. Okay. I'll fast forward. Then that's 92. So fast forward to 93 and he's, oh my God, no, my timeline's completely off. I'm sorry. So I'd actually seen him once before and I'd seen him before. He had been on a major label. He'd been dropped. But when he came out for his first show, opening for Tribe Called Quest, I believe, he comes out. And I know Third Base was on the bill and Black Sheep was on the bill. First time I think Black Sheep played in New York. But he came out in a G-string and a red, white, and blue G-string and a mohawk. And he came out on the stage and he was like, this song's called Yodeling in the Valley. It's for all the bitches. And he started rapping. Suddenly people start throwing quarters at him. And you see like coins getting chucked at this guy's head. He's getting hit by change. And he's like, fuck you, New York. Fuck you. I'm from Detroit. Fuck you. Runs off the stage getting pelted. Doesn't make it through one song. Now fast forward 2 years later. And he's changed his look. And it's even more BMX. And, you know, more sort of X game sort of kid. And the mohawk's gone. But now it's more of a mullet thing. His name's Kid Rock. So there he is, and 2 years later, he's getting mauled at this booth. I think he was on like Continuum Records, you know, and I'm across
the – he figured out his vibe.
He figured out a thing, and I remember thinking, man, this monkey 2 years ago was dancing on a stage, getting quarters, just pelting his fucking head, and look at him now.
You get this could be a good story when he's like senator of
President Rock of the United States. You know, the funny thing is you get easily humbled in this business, and I've been humbled many times, you know. But that day ends, and this is the tale that really sums up my career behind the mic, you know. We do our performance. And do you remember the cassette single? The cassingle?
Yeah.
Right. So Atlantic, you know, provided boxes of our single to give to people. So I think, man, shit, as we're performing, and, you know, it's a band thing. It's like a drummer and a bass player. I'm like, I'm rapping, you know, and singing. And I'm up there, and they think, oh, man, let's just put those on stage, right? So my brilliant idea is I'm going to throw them into the crowd while I'm doing it. These are singles. Now, first thought, sharp corners.
Yeah.
So we go up there, and we're performing. And, you know, as I'm sure you know me well, I'm a super fanboy of everything pop culture, but specifically like deep music, like Head, right? I'm a vinyl guy. I'm a beat junkie. Like I study it. So I know that Teddy Pendergrass is getting wheeled into the back of the room. And, you know, he's paralyzed from the car crash and everyone's like sort of turning their heads towards him. And I'm freaking out because I'm performing in front of Teddy Pendergrass. I know I'm terrible. And he's like in the room. So I'm doing the behind the back tosses of the casingle, you know, left, right. I'm getting kind of nice. I got a little flow going with it, you know, and then suddenly I do a behind the back and I do it with a little bit too much aggression and the casingle starts flying through the air and my mouth just goes agape. I'm just like, oh no. And I see this thing sail through the air and it misses Teddy Pendergrass's face by a centimeter. Goes boom, and everyone stops, and suddenly he is wheeled immediately out, and that's the end of me and Teddy Pendergrass. And these are the eye-opening things that you know you never forget. So yes, what was the original question?
I don't even remember.
Yeah, it's just ADHD.
I got a couple more. If we got time, we're good.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you hope that people say about your music?
Well,
when somebody's listening to it,
you know what? I look at it like this. I feel my career has been a marathon and not a sprint, you know? And a lot of people have had these incredible runs. Writers go on incredible runs. I've had a few incredible, like really great runs. But I would love to believe that the enormity of my catalog someday really registers. And I hope people look back on it. And that's why I wake up every morning. I hate to quote A-Rod because I know you know where I stand on A-Rod. But A-Rod said, coming back from the 50th steroid suspension, he said, you know, at this point I'm playing for my legacy. And I thought, you know, that's some real talk. Like, I feel like I'm playing for my legacy every day I get out there. I'm hoping that at some point I've created a catalog where people say over a very elongated period of time, this dude hit it every single year. He did something that worked. And like as a writer, he hit the consciousness but was quirky. And what I like about it is I've always sort of had that lane of kind of like quirky lyric guy. And I'm proud of it, and I'll take that. And I hope that, you know, I can just keep doing it.
Now, I know when you came out to L.A., what year was it when you came out to L.A.?
Six and a half years ago.
Yes, you came right after me.
Yeah.
You were doing well by then. You had made some hits. I've been to your home studio. You've got some records on the wall.
Yeah.
What's the first one that went up? What was the one where you were like, okay, the wall's got to go up, but I'm building it around. What's the record that you're like, boom, I'm hanging this one?
I mean, you know the answer, right?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No.
Oh, Jock Jams. My first plaque I ever received was for Jock Jams 2, the double platinum record, Joe. And once again, I made a record with a great singer named Sabrina Sang. I developed her, got her signed to Tommy Boy Records. Technically the first artist I ever really got signed. And they didn't put it out. Imagine that, because, you know, that was my thing. But at some point, some genius in accounting over there thought, well, we've lost, you know, a couple hundred thousand or whatever, 150,000 on this girl. So we could either just eat it or we could just take one song from this record and just jam it as the last song on Jock Jams. No one will know. It's the only song they don't know on Jock Jams. And, you know, so I got the token thing. So the album went double platinum, and I remember I emailed Tommy Silverman, who owned Tommy Boy, who's a really fun character. Love Tommy. And I hit him up and I said, hey, you know, how does one go about getting a plaque? And he said, for what? I said, I have a song on Jock Jams. He's like, yeah, but those songs are all like, you know, I said, no, you put the Sabrina Sang song on there. So I got a plaque, and I had them actually, they gave me an extra plaque for my mom, and I gave it to my mom, and my mom had this plaque. I mean, you understand how ugly this plaque is. You can only imagine. And, you know, my mom refused to put it up in the house, but I know she was proud. At least it said something was happening. But so every studio I've ever been at, you know, I got a lot of this crap. You know, the walls are pretty gaudy and awful. But the first one you walk into, always pole position, is Jock Jams, and it will never change. That's the one.
That's incredible.
That's the money shot.
Before we get to kind of the wrap-up questions, there's one guy that we have to talk about that you introduced me to and literally changed my life. And what I, in comedy, still refer to this person as the funniest person I've ever met.
Crazy Bill Fishman?
Rich Cronin.
You know.
Rich Cronin from LFO.
Yeah, Rich Cronin. And, you know, I mean, an LFO, I don't know, you know about Devin, right? So Devin's really sick right now.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Like, it's the craziest story. This band has had such horrible luck. You know, Rich Cronin was, you meet people who really, you know, people can come into your life and just shake your entire world up. And Rich Cronin was really, for me, I think he was the funniest guy I ever met.
He's the funniest guy I've ever met.
And
I work in comedy.
Yeah, I put him in such a rarefied space. You know, he, his narratives, he could tell a story better than anybody I ever knew. And we would do these dinners where he would hold court. He's the kid in LFO, and everyone's clowning on LFO. Oh, shitty pop band, you know. The Chinese, whatever. The song, I don't like Chinese food, you know?
New kids on the block had a bunch of hits. Chinese food makes me sick. And I think it's fly when girls stop by for the summer. I like girls that wear Abercrombie and Fitch.
The summer girls. And, you know, he had two hits. But he was a brilliant orator. And he was a great writer. I mean, I tense up when I think about it, because honestly, I think he would have had an incredible career. Whatever he ended up doing, he was so witty and bright. And we sold a TV show based on you know, Rich's stories. You know, Rich would tell us these stories.
Well, you guys called me up. I was working in TV at the time.
You went down?
And you said, can you go down to Orlando and can you interview the dude from LFO?
Amazing.
So I get down there and I'm like, I don't know. Like, what do you go? Like, how sick did you get from Chinese food? Where do you write this lyric? Like, and I'm there the first day. We just go out and have like hurricanes at like some bar at the Universal lot or whatever. And it's like, what the fuck is this? And by the end of that, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to run camera on him the whole time. And he's a guy that would tell hour-long stories, but you're not bored.
Riveted.
It's like dad riveted jokes where you're like, dad, just get to the punchline. But you're going, what is happening?
With the
fighting Eminem and like
the thickest accent in the world, you know? The thing, Richie, you know? And yeah, he was so great. And, you know, we saw it. Yeah, so we saw the show, Mission Man Band, which ran a whopping 6 episodes on VH1. One of the worst series ever on VH1. Right. The most bungled series. Like, these guys were such douchebags for fucking it up because it could have been a work of art. It was conceptually Mission Man Band, and no one had done it. And the idea was, I knew all these guys from the boy bands, and I knew the tales and the stories because I'd worked with these guys. Because, you know, I was a second or third tier writer in New York for those years. And during that stretch, those guys had all been, you know, these were guys who were coming down off of like their highs, and they were out writing on the circuit, and I would hang with these guys. And the tales were unbelievable. Jeff Timmons, like, I mean, these guys had great stories, you know. And Kirkpatrick, who I adore. I still love Chris Kirkpatrick. I saw him this fall. He was a great kid. But these guys, you know, they were so witty and funny. And Rich was the king. And he really – I can't believe he's gone. And it's one of these things where you still sort of – I hear his voice. I remember everything about this guy.
And I mean, you said me – I probably got 30 hours of footage just sitting in – his place in bars with him, whatever. And just, and when I came, before I turned the footage over to you, I remember I was living in Brooklyn, two roommates, and I'd come home, and one of my roommates would just be, he'd just be sitting there. He's like, I've watched 12 hours of Rich Cronin today.
And there's things I can't even say on this podcast that are some of my favorite quotes ever.
Yeah.
You know, that are.
When I was down there with him in Orlando, he would freestyle rap at the studio where all those records were made. And every rap ended with him, like the closing of every rap was, I have a small dick.
Yes.
That was it. That was the whole thing. And we got drunk, and he stole a NSYNC platinum album off the wall because he still swears they owe him money. And I still have it to this day. The NSYNC record that he woke up the next morning. He's like, you got to take this home with you. I don't want to get caught with it. They probably have me on video.
He was the greatest.
The funniest guy I've ever met. Which artist that you haven't worked with, do you wish you could work with?
You know, every time you sign a publishing deal, the first thing they ask you is that question, right? Because we're going to make it happen, which of course they can't, you know? And in this business, it's so funny because most people say things like, oh, you know, I just want to work with Lady Gaga. I want to work with, you know, I want to work with Michael McDonald.
He came from somewhere back in her long ago.
I've actually been putting that out into the ethosphere, and I've hung with Michael a little bit in the last year, and I feel like that'll happen. But, you know, it's like
– we'll get a Twitter campaign going.
Yeah.
That's
it's worked for you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Look at you. it might get me on the field throwing that pitch, you know. But it – no, you know, I'm open. I would say, like, I've worked with so many people that I never thought I'd work with that I'm not greedy. It's been awesome. You know, and I'm constantly surprised, but sometimes it's like that new kid that nobody knows that, you know, and it works. Like, I would tell you one thing though, 2 years ago, if you asked me, I would have said Fits in the Tantrums, and that's not a lie because that was my favorite band at the time. And I kept trying to find ways to like work with, you know, to navigate it. And, you know, I had never made the cut on the early stuff. I didn't even know Fits, but that was the band. So I need something else like, you know, that excites me the same way those guys do.
If you weren't in the music biz, what would you want to be doing?
Yeah.
And what do you think you'd be doing?
I'm gonna tell you. I'm gonna tell you both are the same because it's what I'm gonna do after this. I'm gonna have equity in a minor league baseball team, and that's all I ever really wanted to do. Like I thought, when music ends, I want to have a part of a Class A baseball team, and I want to have a piece of it, and I want to Bill Veeck it to death, and have, you know, dancing tiny people in the outfield.
Throw out some cassette singles into the crowd.
Have the village people throwing cassette singles in the ground. So I think that's what, you know, that's how the movie should end for me. I feel like.
Is there anything that your parents gave you growing up that sticks out as something that you've gone, I've used this my whole life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I miss my parents. You know, my parents are gone. And the one thing I say about my parents is they preached creativity and coloring outside the lines, and, you know, just they weren't conformists. Specifically my mom, you know, my mom really wasn't a conformist. And I think, you know, she, unfortunately there's genes that, you know, I was discussing this yesterday with my kid, you know, I'm a cynic, and to the point of where it really affects my daily behavior and honestly makes me more of a douchebag. And I hate that I'm so cynical and I don't trust things. That's my mom. I hear my mom's voice. I go, oh, yeah, don't believe that, you know. But the creativity and the art and really being great at something and master something and go, and learn process. I take it that's a learn process. Whatever you do, master process. Like, you know, I didn't understand that when she said it to me as a kid, because especially when you're an ADHD kid and you just can't get your shit together and you have somebody always saying, follow the steps. And I couldn't do it. But with music, I followed the steps.
Well, I want to tell you, because it's full circle on our relationship and on this interview. I have questions for you on my phone, and obviously the iPhone locks automatically in between. So the last time I went to open my phone before I did, my notifications came up. I have a Facebook notification. Doug Ray's record release party is happening as we speak. The album drops tomorrow.
That's an amazing thing. Hey, you know, shout out.
And it's finally just Doug Ray.
Can I tell you something? You know what? this is like Chris Gaines for Garth Brooks, you know? He's shedding it, but I love this kid so much, and you know what? I don't care what you do in life, you know, if you have a day gig or whatever path your journey takes, never stop creating and never stop chasing it, because at the end of the day, you never know what happens. You just never know. There are no rules. It's complete anarchy. You just do you, and crazy shit happens.
Thanks for being here, dude.
Hey, that was fucking awesome. Thank you, sir.
All these lovers got you losing control. You like a drug to me, a luxury, my sugar and gold. I want the good life every good night. You're a hot one to hold, 'cause you don't even know. I can make your hands clap. Said I can make your hands clap. Somebody save your soul, 'cause you've been sinning in the city. I know too many troubles. All these lovers got you losing control. You like a drug to me, a luxury, my sugar and gold. Your sex and your affection when they're holding you close, 'cause you don't even know. I can make your hands clap. Said I can make your hands clap.
Every night when the stars come out,